had said a couple weeks back that I was going to get my shit together and get the podcast going a little bit more regularly and more consistent a few weeks back. And then I took a 2-week break because I just couldn't get my shit together. Long story short, I mean, as everyone knows, the last episode we did was about the coronavirus and how it has impacted the scene and the music industry in general. And at the end of Q1, which was the end of March, like it was for many other people, some things just had to take priority over others. But now that things have kind of, you know, settled down and in regards to pushing through the end of a quarter, I'm going to get back to weekly episodes for the time being, just because it's easier for my end, and it's just what I can do right now as far as the amount of, you know, time that goes into everything on the editing side and putting ideas together and things like that. I'm not going to have any guests on for the near future. If a unique situation comes up, like I wanted to have that dumbass from Trapped on just in an attempt to talk some sense into him, I'll bring someone on. But keeping shows at like a 30 to 40 minute length with just myself is what's doable for me for right now. But that being said, since we're all, you know, stuck at home and spring's in full swing and we're heading straight for summer, usually, I mean, in the past when Warped Tour was still going on, this was the time when the lineup would be getting announced and we'd be getting waves of bands every week and it would be super exciting heading into another summer. So I thought it'd be fun to look back on what Warped Tour looked like 10 years ago in 2010. And the scene was kind of, at the time, exiting its transitional neon, crunk, post-hardcore, kind of weird MySpace scene wave of the late 2000s and heading like straight into what would be the scene's second peak that it reached from like 2013, 2014, and partially 2015. The scene looked a lot different a decade ago and definitely a lot more promising. Just looking at the lineup 10 years ago, it's crazy to think about these bands and where they were in their career. I haven't been able to find an actual lineup of what bands played what dates on which stages. I've seen a lot of like, from what's left of the archives on the internet of 2010, I've seen a lot of like conflicting dates and things like that. But some bands that just played main stage that year, you had 303, All American Rejects, Alkaline Trio, Andrew WK, Bring Me the Horizon, Dillinger Escape Plan, Dropkick Murphys, Every Time I Die, Motion City Soundtrack, Pennywise, Real Big Fish, Set Your Goals. Set Your Goals is so interesting. That band was going to be so fucking huge. Sum 41, We the Kings. We the Kings was still relevant. But even going down outside of the main stage, the amount of bands that went on to at least make somewhat of a name for themselves during that time, it's crazy to think about. So outside of the main stage, you had Attack Attack, Breathe Carolina, Confide, Emir, 4 Year Strong, Haste the Fucking Day. When I was doing some research earlier today for this episode, I looked up some old videos of Haste the Day playing in 2010 on Warped Tour, and it was so cool to see that band. You had Hey Monday, Icy Stars, In Fear and Faith, Parkway Drive, Pierce the Veil, Suicide Silence, Whitechapel. I mean, the list goes on. It's pretty crazy to see all the different names that played that year. You had Enter Shikari, I Wrestled a Bear Once. It's really, really a nostalgia trip. Versa Emerge. I believe this was the year there was a show on MTV called World of Janks, and he would just take individuals just completely randomly from around, you know, the world, and he would just kind of shadow them for a day and kind of go through and unpack what they're experiencing mentally and things like that. It was a super, super short-lived show. I think the theme song was a Kid Cudi song, but he did a whole episode with Sierra from Versa, and I believe it was when she was on Warped Tour this summer. But super, super interesting to unpack what that lineup was back then. And 2 years later, in 2012, Warped Tour released like a full-length documentary film called No Room for Rock Stars, and it was about this tour. And they picked just a handful of bands and acts, and they kind of followed them around on the whole tour and just documented exactly what they were going through at that time. They had Never Shout Never, Suicide Silence, Mike Posner, and Forever Came Calling, who Forever Came Calling weren't even signed at that point. They were literally just a local band trying to sell CDs in the line before every date of the tour. And they eventually got signed to Pure Noise, released two albums, I believe, on Pure Noise, and then I think their third one might have come out independently. They were one of my favorite new wave pop punk bands of, you know, like pop punk's second golden age, if you could even call it that. But, I mean, just to even look at one band on this tour, say Never Shout Never, and unpack exactly where Chris was at that time, it is crazy to think about where he was poised to be and what he was, you know, the foundation and the stage that he was thrusted into after all of his MySpace success. Just the Never Shout Never footage of the show kind of documents his life during that time and how everything was just kind of sucked from him after the tour was over. I've met Chris and a lot of people like Chris over the years, and you can tell in his demeanor, especially in the beginning interviews, it's a fake type of innocence. And as soon as shit starts going south for people with that mentality, they fall apart and just say, fuck it. He sprains his ankle at some point in the tour, not even maybe like midway through. And by the end of the film, he is over absolutely everything and just wants to go home. It's crazy to think about how big Never Shout Never was supposed to be. They were a major label band. Nobody remembers that at all. The amount of hype that he built off of his MySpace page is absolutely ridiculous. And to think about, you know, his at least from what I know of his backstory, this might not be accurate at all, but this is what he would tell people. And I think I read it in an AP interview years ago, but he was like supposedly this tennis prodigy, and he broke his ankle or he broke something and he was in the hospital, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't looking like tennis was going to pan out for him. And his uncle brought him a guitar, and that's how he started playing music. But the amount of momentum and hype that Christopher Drew built off the MySpace years from the Yippie EP. I think there was some sort of like demo schmemo thing, I think it was called. But you had songs like Big City Dreams, and there's a couple other that I'm forgetting off the top of my head. But he built so much momentum off of this kind of like, you know, peace and love. And he always had a fucking like raccoon tail, and he had great hair. I know I always talk about hair, but that kid had the best fucking hair. And he owned his entire look all the way up until he started getting fame, and then he was completely over it. And it was wild to watch at the time. And now to think about how we haven't heard from him in years, it's like, holy shit. Like, remember that Never Shout Never actually happened. But I don't have first week sales for him, but in 2010, in January of that year, he had released his first album. It actually debuted at number 24 on the top 200, and then he released his second full-length, Harmony, later that year, that same year. I mean, he was literally on like a hip-hop, like hip-hop's current release schedule. You put out like two albums a year. I know he only had like eight or so songs on every quote unquote album, and the songs were super, super short, but the amount of content that he was pumping out is super interesting to look at now, considering everyone's kind of release schedules. But that second album also debuted even higher than the first one at number 24. And then pretty much after that, it all fell apart. I mean, he released an album called Indigo, and he just got way, way, way too weird for any of his fan base from the early days to latch on to anything that he was doing after that second Never Shout Never album. And he like attempted to return to form at like a couple different points. I think he released an album called Sunflower, but other than that, he really just let it go to his head a little bit too much, and he didn't want any of what he thought he wanted, and it all just fell apart from there. But in 2015, Warner did attempt to make Never Shout Never happen again. Like, say what you want about major labels, but there was an attempt to really still make him happen even after it had all fallen apart. But I have a story from the 2015 APMAs that I'll tell on some episode down the line. But Christopher Drew's an incredible story, and whoever writes the book on the scene, he's gonna take quite a few pages out of the MySpace era, and the downfall of Never Shout Never is super, super interesting to unpack. But The film also talks about Suicide Silence, who played the whole tour that year. And it's so unfortunate to think about this band and only be able to kind of remember how much their name has been dragged through the mud over the last couple of years. I mean, they released that complete bullshit self-titled album. The songs were absolute ass. Ross Robinson produced it. And I mean, it made a laughing stock of Suicide Silence. They literally, like, they took the deathcore scratched out logo that they had and they literally just cleaned it up to make it look like more legible and more marketable and shit like that. And the songs were just complete ass. Like, they're not actually songs. They sound terrible. Absolutely terrible. There's no structure to him. Eddie is a horrible, horrible, horrible fucking frontman, and he should have never, never, never gotten behind the wheel of Suicide Silence. And it's super, super disappointing to look back on their legacy and how much it's been ruined because of him and where the band has decided to take things. Because at this time in 2010, they were on the No Time to Bleed cycle, and Mitch Lucker was just starting to become a poster boy for what, you know, that Hot Topic wave that was literally at that point falling apart all around them, because metalcore was taking over. Rise Records had become the coolest label in the business, and deathcore bands were either going metalcore or they were just breaking up and falling apart. You kind of saw that with Miss May I. Like, that first Miss May I record, Apologies Are for the Weak, that's Hot Topic deathcore to a T. But by the time they got to their second album, it's literally just modern metalcore. They left all of the deathcore elements out of what they continued with. But Suicide Silence doubled down, and they got heavier. I mean, I love The Cleansing. That's one of my favorite deathcore records of all time. The snare on that record is one of my favorite snares of all time. There is so much fucking pop in that. It's absolutely ridiculous. But it was so interesting to look, and I remember thinking about it at the time, because Suicide Silence looked like Lamb of God, but they had like Ollie Sykes as their frontman. Like, they had this super marketable poster boy that could carry them as far as image goes, you know? Like, they weren't, Mitch didn't have a massive beard, and he wasn't wearing camo cargo shorts, and he didn't have super long hair. He kind of looked like Ollie Sykes. He had tattoos, he was just covered in them, super skinny, lanky dude. And he was the poster boy that really gave other fans that maybe weren't necessarily into deathcore as a whole something to latch onto. And that's super important. And no one wants to recognize that, but image is literally half your battle as a band. And he gave Suicide Silence what so many deathcore bands didn't have during that Hot Topic wave. But it's really bittersweet to see the footage of him with his daughter, Kennedy, because we didn't really have another... The scene didn't have another death that was on the same level as Mitch's. It was just super unique given where Suicide Silence were in their career at that time, because you can kind of say Kyle Pavone from We Came as Romans, that was obviously very large and incredibly significant, but We Came as Romans were at a very different point in their career than Suicide Silence. Suicide Silence in 2010, even before they had released You Only Live Once, but once they had released that album a couple years later, the metal scene was taking them seriously. They had gotten cosigns from Lamb of God. They had gotten cosigns from bands that existed outside of not only deathcore, but the scene as a whole. And it was really looking like Suicide Silence was going to find a way to break out in a way that we hadn't really seen a heavy band do from the scene, especially one that heavy. But Mitch had a vision for that band, and they were going in a lot of different directions, and you can kind of see where the band was trying to go on that bullshit self-titled album, where Mitch wanted to take it. They just failed completely. Like, they bastardized his image for that band, and it was such a fucking shame to see, because if you go back and listen to those Suicide Silence records with Mitch, all three of them, they're great, great fucking records. Even that first one, I mean, it's a very run-of-the-mill deathcore record, but it's to a T, Hot Topic deathcore at its finest, and it's such a shame that we lost him at such a young age. But this documentary and the footage that you get to see of Mitch is it's just super insightful, and I'm glad that they got this documented in some way, because we don't really have much else besides DVDs from Suicide Silence themselves. But as far as outside sources, this is kind of the biggest one that I'm aware of. But I highly recommend it, if even if you're not a fan of deathcore or just a fan of the scene. It's great historical documentation, what they did with Suicide Silence on here. But other than that, they talked to Mike Posner. They followed him around because he was the big superstar at the time on Warped Tour. And Warped Tour is known for taking out acts that aren't necessarily part of the scene, or even obviously necessarily part of the scene. They've had everyone from Eminem, Limp Bizkit, Kid Rock, fucking, you know, the Black Eyed Peas. They've had so many artists play the tour over the years, but I think they definitely got into after emo's peak in the mid 2000s with My Chem and Fall Out Boy and Panic. They got a name for themselves, and Warped Tour's brand was built around only emos go here, and it's not true at all. They definitely had that was definitely the names that carried that tour and what they became known for, but they definitely incorporated a lot of other genres throughout the years, and Mike Posner was definitely one of them. He had the song Cooler Than Me take off, and it's so funny because he's in there and he doesn't know anyone who's on the tour. He's never heard of any of those bands before. He's talking about how he's pulling double duty on a lot of the dates throughout the tour too. He's gonna go play a set during the day, and then he's gonna go play at a club that night in whatever city they're at, which it's crazy. But he was making so much money that summer, but he literally says, he's like, I've already sold more records than 95% of the bands on this tour have or ever will. And I thought that was fucking hilarious. He didn't care. And he was a pop star poised to be on top of the world and take it over. But as we saw with him, it all fell apart too. But he has gotten a Grammy nomination since for his song, I Took a Pill in Ibiza. And I believe he was trying to like walk across the country last year. I could be totally fucking this up, but I think this is right. He tried to walk across the country last year and he got bit by some poisonous snake and he got hospitalized for it. And it was like some serious thing, but he recovered from it and he's okay. But I remember that story popping up last year and I was like, holy shit, remember Mike Posner when he played Warped Tour? And then all the metalcore covers of Cooler Than Me all came rushing back, which was hilarious because they were so fucking bad. All the pure volume metalcore covers of 2010, 2011, 2012, those were maybe some parts of the scene that should remain buried. But the other band that they followed was a band called Forever Came Calling, which I talked about earlier. They were selling CDs in the line at the different dates, and they end up not making enough money to make it to other dates, and they're, you know, stealing from gas stations, and then they kind of have just a bit of a breakdown and it all gets a little too much for them. And but they do end up getting to play a date, and they eventually got signed by Pure Noise Records, I think, because of that documentary. So I definitely recommend going to check out those first two Forever Came Calling albums. Great modern pop punk band. But also, there wasn't an insane amount of drama on the 2010 Warped Tour, as there had been in past years. You know, you had Fat Mike and NoFX versus Spencer Chamberlain and Aaron Gillespie of Under Oath, and just drama between old heads and new heads and shit like that. But there was a bit of a drama between the Of Mice and Men camp and Austin Carlisle and their, at the time, their new vocalist, Jerry Roush. And a lot of people don't remember this at all, but it did happen because Austin Carlisle had gotten basically let go of Mice and Men, because at that time, he had to get surgery done, like a very significant surgery, and it was going to take Of Mice and Men off the touring schedule for a good amount of time. And they obviously didn't want to. They were touring on their debut full length, and shit was really picking up for them. The album was definitely a success at that point, and they were gaining new fans left and right. And when you have that kind of momentum and you have an opportunity to do Warped Tour, you fucking take it, because that's going to catapult your band, absolutely. And so they basically let Austin go, and they got Jerry Roush, who was the not even the original vocalist from Sky Eats Airplane, but at the time I believe he had just left right before this, and he was kind of looking for one. But Skite's Airplane was like the forefathers to like a different breed of electronic metalcore than what the scene had seen at that point. And, you know, they had garnered a little bit of a fan base. So Of Mice and Men got Jerry. And at this point, Jerry was kind of poised to be a poster boy a little bit for the scene. Like, he wasn't a star yet, but with this getting updrafted to Of Mice and Men, you know, it's the follow-up project to Attack Attack after Austin Carlisle got kicked out. And there's so much drama and everything's building, and they dropped the record. And there was an Attack Attack diss track, 7,000 Miles for What? And then they had a single takeoff, Second in Sebring, which is about Austin Carlisle's mom. And now Austin Carlisle's out of the band. So they're like, is there beef there? We didn't really know what to think about the situation, but we were just enthralled by it. And so on the Bonner Springs date, August 2nd, 2010, Jerry has been on the tour fronting Of Mice and Men for the whole thing. And he forgets the lyrics. I don't know if this was accidentally or intentionally, because this wasn't the first date he had done vocals for them, and he had gotten them right in the past. So I don't know if he was, you know, maybe a little intoxicated and just forgot, or just said, fuck it, whatever. But Second in Sebring, like I said, is about Austin Carlisle's mom who passed away. And Jerry forgets the lyrics. And as he's forgetting the lyrics, while the band is playing the rest of the song, he goes, this song goes out to Austin Carlisle. I don't fucking like you, Austin Carlisle. Austin Carlisle is a motherfucking pussy. And this video is still on YouTube. It turns 10 on August 2nd this year. And this was so, like, this was such a big fucking deal at the time. And YouTube, obviously, in no way what it was then as it is today, or else this video would have been so much bigger. It literally only has, like, 130,000 views or a little bit over that, I think. But it is such a moment, because nobody remembers that Austin Carlisle didn't front Of Mice and Men at one point before Aaron Pauly took over. But That's one thing I love about the Punk Goes Pop series, is because they serve as like these documentational points in bands' careers where they were off cycle and they just went in to record this one song and put it on there. Because Attack Attack recorded their cover of I Kissed a Girl with the replacement. God, I cannot remember what this kid's name is off the top of my head, but they had a vocalist in between Austin Carlisle and Caleb Shomo, and I cannot remember what his fucking name is, but he recorded the vocals, the screaming vocals, on their I Kissed a Girl cover, and he is also the screamer in the Stick Stickley video. Of Mice and Men on Punk Goes Pop 5 covered Blame It, and it is the only song they recorded with Jerry on vocals, and it is also one of the best Punk Goes Pop covers of all time, and definitely top 10 scene metalcore covers of all time for sure. But this is such an interesting point. I mean, eventually Jerry got kicked out because he was just being a dick, and Austin became well enough to tour again and wasn't gonna, you know, hinder the band from touring at all or any opportunities like that for that time being, and they brought him back. But that was such a fucking time, because no one remembers that Jerry was in Of Mice and Men and all the drama that ensued after it on that summer. But the last thing I really want to talk about is Kevin Lyman, and how at this time, and even a little bit before this and after it, you know, for a couple more years, he really was seen as kind of like the father of a lot of these bands and the go-to guy when, you know, bands needed advice or, you know, a help up. He understood the way the music industry works and what it took to make bands take off. And he was there to help bands out, you know? Like, you watch any sort of footage of Kevin from back in the day, he's like, hey, how are you doing? Can I get you something to eat? You want some food? Like, we're grilling, we got food everywhere, you need water, like, what do you need? How can I help you? And you're a complete stranger to him, you know? Like, he doesn't owe you anything. You're on his tour, that should be enough, but he didn't care, you know? He was out there to help these bands and help everyone who was on the tour, and it was really like a family environment. And the conversation, even before the sentiment about Kevin Lyman and Warped Tour started to change around 2015, you still had people that were trying to voice their opinion on why Warped Tour shouldn't exist, and for all these different things that I'm not going to get into because it would make this a 2-hour long episode. But bottom line is that Kevin Lyman went from a hero to a villain in about 3 years, and it's super, super unfortunate. There's not a poisonous bone in that dude's body. Like, he did all of this to help all these bands, and it definitely made a few mistakes, as anyone would, you know, and he's admitted to that, a lot of it. But Lyman is a great businessman, and he gave our world a platform to grow and thrive. And Warped Tour died because of a lot of different reasons, but one of them was that there was this sentiment shift among newer bands that were coming up, and a lot of emo's fourth wave. And he talked about that in an interview last year, and I screenshotted some of what he said, and I put up my own take about it on Twitter, and fourth wave emo definitely awoken and canceled the hell out of me. But I talk about things in a business way. I'm not speaking on morality. I'm not speaking on what's right and wrong. I'm speaking about how to make your band bigger. And that's what Warped Tour did. If you did Warped Tour right, it was there to help your band. If you were a complete fucking shithead, then you shouldn't have been out there, and your band shouldn't go fucking anywhere. But he said in this interview, the bands that I thought would have been fantastic for this were bands like Balance and Composure, La Dispute, Touche Amore. I love those bands. I think they're great musical bands, but their attitudes of their little community, they don't want to break outside of that little community. Modern Baseball, I think, could have been one of the most massive bands out there, but they got caught up in their own bullshit. No one is too precious to break out of your own shell, and I felt they were. And I'd watch their careers, and every year I'd send offers, and they'd be like, oh, we don't want to tour with those bands. We don't want to be a Warped-esque band. And I took screenshots of that, and I quote it. I said, Kevin Lyman did an interview about Warped and the awful mentality of new wave emo bands. This is why it's so refreshing to see a band like Knocked Loose support A Day to Remember and then take out See You Space Cowboy. Bands can shoot themselves in the foot all they want, but fuck elitism. And I stand by that. Like, that's literally everything I preach on this show. It's, you know, Knocked Loose isn't afraid to go out with bands like Motionless and White and A Day to Remember and then take out a dope new band like See You Space Cowboy and exist inside the hardcore scene when they're not touring with those bigger bands and making their band bigger. You know, there's a different conception about how you treat your band. Your band is a business, and your band should want to get bigger. That's all I'm talking about, though, is from the business side of things, Warped Tour was fantastic for your band, and I think there was ways to use Warped Tour to do good. Like, no one ever wants to point about all the food drives and all the women that were behind Warped Tour that made the tour happen every single year. And I think all of that gets shoved under the rug way too much. Were there bad things that happened on Warped Tour? Absolutely. And there should have been more conversations and better ways that we dealt with all of that. But to say that Kevin Lyman is a villain, you know, looking back on the history of Warped Tour and kind of how it ended in this unfortunate, like, gray cloud around it, I think that is complete bullshit. And just looking back on even just the small amount of time that I put into preparing this episode and, like, going back and looking at these bands, and fuck, we're all locked in the fucking house at this point anyways. But just remembering, like, going to Warped Tour for the first time and seeing Enter Shikari and seeing the Wonder Years and seeing Bring Me from, like, 2 football fields away, this tour gave a launch pad for our world. And literally, like, if it wasn't for Warped Tour, we wouldn't have anything of what we have now. It wouldn't exist. And if that's a hard pill to swallow for you and you won't admit it, I'm sorry, but that's the truth. There's something that needs to be said about what Lyman did for the scene and, you know, how he shouldn't be looked back on as the villain of it all, because he did so much good for so many people. But Warped Tour 2010 was fun as hell, and it's so crazy to look back on all of those bands from the lineup before, and even just take out, like, one or two. Like, think about where Enter Shikari was at that point in time in their career in 2010, and just to see all those names in one ad, Matt, you know, the beginning of IC Stars, which we literally learned over the weekend that Austin Carlisle almost joined IC Stars after he got kicked out of Attack, which is crazy to think about. If he joins Icy Stars, we don't get Of Mice and Men, and Of Mice and Men doesn't become one of the biggest bands at the scene at one point. And that affects a lot. Like, the butterfly effect of all of that is pretty crazy to think about. But if you went to Warped Tour 2010, send me an email. Like, I'd love to hear about what bands you saw, and in general, like, moving forward for the show. Like, send me what you want to hear me talk about. I'm looking for ideas. If you want me to go back to doing news stories of everything that happens in the scene throughout the week, which there's less and less of, but if that's what you all want to hear me talk about, then I'll figure out how to make that happen. Or if you want more nostalgic deep dives or unpacking certain bands' careers, I'll take anything you all want to throw at me. But just send anything you'd like to notetoscene@gmail.com, and I'll take a look and figure out what we'll do for next week. But until then, thank you so much for listening.